I'm Jim Florentine. I'm one of Artie's friends, and I'm here because I think he just is too lazy to finish the book, so he called me in to do it, and hey, I'll pick up the slack, no problem. He's throwing me a few bucks, and it's all good. And hopefully when my book ever comes out, when I don't feel like finishing it, he'll come in and rescue me. Pig and Shit. It should be clear by now to everyone listening that I started abusing drugs and alcohol with particular gusto as a result of the sudden, tragic, and devastating accident that crippled my father and my family for 4.5 years. My mother and sister could have easily gone down the same road or a similar one to cope with the heartache, the stress, and the financial burden of living as a family in the aftermath of that event. Thank God they did not. They stayed strong and they took care of me too, as I found my way through my own suffering along a pretty dark, winding route. For the record, my sister supported my decision to chase my dream as much as if not even more than my mother did. After leaving the security of Port Newark and doing my first regular paying gig in show business, my stint in dinner theater, I dove into the New York City comedy club scene. I was cheered on by good friends like Jimmy Palumbo and Mike Stafford, as well as my mother's brothers and sisters, my younger cousin Frankie, and my older cousin Jeff, who might have been the biggest comedic influence. Jeff gave me my first George Carlin album, Class Clown, and Woody Allen's The Early Years, an album of Woody's greatest stand-up from the 60s. Without these people, I would have been really miserable. Drinking and drugs were, at first, a rebellious knee-jerk reaction to cover the pain and get through my shitty everyday life. But it changed on me, like it does to anyone with tendencies like mine. So during that period, I developed an addiction to cocaine and booze. It was easy to do. I spent as much time as I could for nearly 4 years in and around comedy clubs, which are hardly healthy, clean living environments. I met a lot of fellow dreamers in that world, and they introduced me to coke. I say introduced me because although I'd done it plenty of times before, I never experienced that drug the way I did then. Doing a bag of coke with your friends whenever some dealer was selling it in a bar was a universe away from doing gram after gram all night and into the next day and into the day after that with no end in sight to the supply. At that intensity, coke was a whole new drug to me, and I was happy to make its acquaintance. Once I started to get regular stand-up slots around town, it was a no-brainer. There were 3-day periods where I'd just stay up the whole time, chasing the dream and the high. I'd do a gig, score some coke at a club, and keep doing it until my next time slot later that night. I might do another gig at another club and score some more coke there, then I'd go to after-hours places. I'd do more there, partying until the morning, hitting a few bars in the afternoon and finish my coke, and then go to another comedy club, score some more, and do another gig or two. Tuesday through Thursday, with proper planning, I could stay high nonstop without spending much money at all. That was great because I didn't have much to spend. People in audience at clubs always seemed to have coke and were eager to hang out with comedians. Believe me, if you were a regular comic, there were plenty of ways to get coke for free or very inexpensively. Cocaine makes fast friends, and one of my fastest best buddies at the time was this party monster who worked at a big Wall Street firm, loved comedy clubs, and had a corporate Amex that he enjoyed throwing down to cover bar tabs all night long. I remember thinking I finally seen the face of the devil one night at an after-hours club on the East Side when he used his corporate card to buy us more coke. I thought it was a joke, but this place actually accepted credit cards for cocaine purchases. The guy behind the bar swiped in and handed us an 8-ball as if it were a round of drinks. If that's not the embodiment of Satan in this day and age, I don't know what is. I looked at my buddy like he was Lucifer himself and decided right away that I was cool with hanging out with the devil as long as he can get me coke. That was my struggling period, and as I said before, I'm lucky it lasted only 3.5 years, until the day God opened the heavens and shone a golden light down upon me. I got cast on Mad TV as one of 8 permanent cast members chosen from 8,000 comics who had been screened. For any comic trying to make something of themselves, that was like hitting 777s, jackpot. Landed a spot as a regular on a network sketch show in L.A. was specifically one of my dreams. Unlike a lot of comics, I didn't care about getting on Saturday Night Live. That show had such history and was so established that I didn't see the point. I wanted to be on an original show as an original cast member of a sketch comedy troupe, and I couldn't believe it when that exact scenario happened for me. In May 1995, I went to LA to shoot a pilot, which got picked up by Fox and put into the fall rotation slated to debut on October 14, 1995. I was overjoyed that all this was happening for me after wanting it for so long because finally I felt justified in my life choices just a bit. So in July, I packed up and moved to LA ready to begin work on the show. I was 27 years old and everything was great, except for the fact that along with a bunch of old concert t-shirts, I took my crazy drug problem with me to the West Coast. I was now making huge money, $7,500 an episode plus a big signing bonus, all of which I intended to enjoy. I had my New York City drug dealer hook me up with a contact in LA, and the second I got there, I continued doing coke like it was going out of style. Everything had done nothing but get better for me, so I saw no problem with it. I figured that I could live like that for years. My rationale for the whole thing was that someday I'd quit, and the best time for that was my late 30s. But right now, it was party time. Of course, I didn't realize at all how crazy and stressful shooting the show would be, and I thought it'd be sketch comedy as I'd done it in New York, which is creative and inspiring with some pressure involved, but it was mostly pressure we put on ourselves to be great. I had no idea how differently that would play out on a fully budgeted network program. For 3 straight weeks, 6 days a week, we rehearse sketches, then shoot them live in front of a studio audience on Fridays. Then we'd shoot commercial and movie parodies on location for 2 weeks. 1 week for rehearsal, 1 week for shooting. So there was no break for ages, and that's how it had to be. The format of the show was solid sketch comedy. We didn't have musical guests, so we needed 8 solid hours of sketches, each with different characters, voices, and everything else that was involved. There were only 8 cast members, so it was a lot of work, but I welcomed the challenge. I got through the first 8 episodes the way I've been getting through everything in my life, by drinking and doing a lot of coke and working as hard as I could. That was fine in the stand-up world because I was the only one responsible for my act and getting to the gig on time. But on Mad TV, there were 8 other cast members to consider, plus a huge crew, call times, schedules, union rules. It was too complicated for that kind of one-man show I was running. It was bound to come to a head, and it did. The last sketch we did before taking a break was called Babe Watch. We were shooting it way out in Malibu for 2 15-hour days, so instead of having everyone drive home, they put us up in this little motel. Babe Watch was a parody of Baywatch starring me as Babe the Pig, who becomes a lifeguard. If you had to equate me with a character on the real show, then I, as Babe the Pig, would have been David Hasselhoff. As you could see, the whole concept was ridiculous. The first day of filming this monstrosity was the worst day of my life in show business. My call time was 4 a.m. because I had to endure 3 hours of prosthetic makeup application that left me looking exactly, and I mean exactly, like a pig. The Mad TV makeup artist was as good as it got on TV. She had left SNL to work on Mad TV, and she was great. Her name is Jen Aspinall. I love Jen. She had a really sweet way about her. She still works there, and I wish her the best and miss her very much. Anyway, this mask was by far the most high-budget makeup effect I saw in the entire 2 years I worked on the show. After 3 hours in pig makeup, I had a snout, pig ears, a layer of white fuzz on my back, and 6 teats, each of which was going to get its own bikini top. And I was like a grunge pig. I had to wear a dirty flannel shirt, cut-off jean shorts, a wallet chain, and a backward baseball hat. They dressed me to look like a pig on his way to a Pearl Jam concert. They did a great job, too, because when Jen was done with me, I was disgusting. Just a 2-legged, talking man pig. There's no other way to describe it. The skit was horrible in every way because there was way too much effort going into it. The whole thing was a cheap shot gag centered around me, the prosthetic pig. It was strange to be up so early getting transformed into a pig in a place that's as perfect as Malibu. It's that typical ideal California coastline of nothing but beach and sun and beautiful ocean that comes straight out of a Beach Boys song. The environment freaked me out. It would have been easy to take if I was in a studio. By the time my makeup was done, I was depressed and hungry. So I went over to the catering area, got some breakfast, and took it into my little trailer. I sat down and started to eat. But every time I went to take a bite of my eggs, I catch a glimpse of myself in the mirror. There I was, this pig, eating. I was hungry too, which made it worse, because I was literally a fake pig who was eating like a pig. Ugh, Jesus, I said out loud to myself, this is not why I signed up for show business. I finished the rest of my food, getting more and more annoyed with every bite. There was only one thing to do, call my coke dealer. I told him where I was and asked him to come to meet me. I couldn't have him show up at the set, so he told me to meet him at Duke's, a seafood restaurant not too far away on the Pacific Coast Highway. It's got a huge self-park parking lot, which in LA is fucking rare because everywhere you go, there's a valet dipshit waiting to park your car and charge you anywhere from $3 to $20 to do it. I fucking hate that shit. Anyway, we decided to meet at Duke's. Can you get there, man? He asked. Oh, yeah, I said. There's no question that I'd get there. Without coke to pass the 15 hours I had to spend in this pig getup, I would drown myself in the Pacific. Because I was the lead of the sketch, two assistant directors had to be aware of my whereabouts because it was their responsibility to wrangle all the cast members when it was time to start shooting. I was going to have to find a way to give them the slip. Apparently, they were having problems getting the lighting right for the first shot, so I seized the opportunity and sprinted in my car in the full pig outfit, teats, ears, and everything. As I sped away off the lot, I saw one of the assistant directors waving his arms at me. Hey, he shouted, his voice fading behind me. Where are you going? The Pacific Coast Highway is a winding four-lane strip right on the edge of the ocean, and I tore down that thing at about 90 miles an hour, just a pig who wanted his coke. My makeup was so good that the tone matched my skin perfectly, and every time I looked in the rear view, it was just uncanny to see myself that way. When I catch people's eye at traffic lights, they did a double take. I think at first they thought I was deformed, but after a second look, there was no mistake in that pig snout profile. If you were next to me, you would have said, look at that, it's a pig. Driving. I got to Duke's parking lot, went to the far end of it, like my dealer said, and sat there waiting. I was so antsy to get my drugs, so focused on the moment his car would turn into the parking lot, that after a while I forgot about the pig makeup, which was far from comfortable. When I finally saw my dealer drive in, it was like Jesus Christ appearing before me. I jumped out of the car and ran over to him. He was a black kid from inner city LA, and he was not prepared for what he saw. What the fuck is wrong with you, man? He said, generally disgusted. The fuck kind of sick shit you into? Dude, I told you I was on TV, I said. What the fuck kind of show you on, man? That shit ain't right. I'm a mad TV, man. We're doing some stupid skit and I have to be a pig, I said. No shit, you're on mad TV, he said. That shit is funny. You didn't tell me you're on mad TV. Who's that blonde chick on the show, man? Nicole Sullivan. Yeah, Nicole Sullivan. She's hot, man. You work with her? Damn, man, what's she like? I then had to have a 15-minute conversation about Nicole Sullivan with this guy in my full pig face standing outside in the parking lot of Duke's. And after that, he wanted to know all about what it was like to work on a comedy show and how we came up with all the shit we did on the air. The concept of team writers was definitely new to him. While this incredibly painful dialogue went on, I was on the verge of literally attacking the guy to get my fucking coke. I would have just told him I didn't have the time and throw my money at him, but I didn't have the cash to cover the eight ball I ordered, so I felt I had to hang out and endure his endless line of questioning. He was a great drug dealer, this guy. He came with a line of credit, so I could put the coke on my tab. I'm sure he didn't give everyone that treatment, but I was on a TV show, so he knew I was good for it. Besides, at the time, I was what any drug dealer would call a very good customer. The only thing I felt incredibly guilty about is that back then Nicole Sullivan was single, and I totally forgot to tell her that she could have dated this guy. After I got my eight ball and my dealer took off, I started tearing through my backseat looking for something to do it with. That didn't take long. Like a true coke addict, I had a nice selection of cut straws available. I was so focused on my drugs that I forgot again about the pig mask as I went to stick the straw on my nose. The thing hit my snout, bent in half, and got nowhere near my actual nostril. I tried it like three times, wanting to get the coke in me so bad that my brain did not compute why the hell the straw wasn't connecting my nose to the drugs. I pinched the end of the straw, got it in there good enough, and sniffed as hard as I could. expecting my snout to work just like my real nostril. Obviously, that failed miserably. I was on the verge of opening it all up on the passenger seat and just stuffing my whole snout in a desperate pig-like attempt to get high. I hoped to do my drugs without disturbing Jen's work, but that wasn't happening. So I took the straw and started to dig with abandon into this expensive prosthetic stuff like I was tunneling out of a prison. Finally, I managed to crack a hole in the bottom of the snout and get the straw up there and into my nose. I inhaled a line of coke as fast, as hard, as if it was my first drink of water after walking across the Sahara. At that moment, I didn't give a fuck about where I was, what I looked like, or what kind of shit I was going to get for walking off the set. Those people could all fuck themselves as far as I was concerned. All I cared about was getting some relief. Sure enough, once I was high, everything got a little better. So of course, the obvious decision was to feel a whole lot better by doing a whole lot more coke before I went to work. But since I was now high, I was also now paranoid that everyone on the set would know I'd run out to get coke. I was also worried that Jen would see that I poked a hole in the snout the size of a straw. I kept trying to look at the damage in the mirror and the sun visor to make sure I didn't have blow all over my face. I bent the thing every which way, but for the fucking life of me, I couldn't see under that snout. Every time I lifted my head high enough, my big pig cheeks blocked the view. My only option was to go in the restaurant bathroom to do my drugs as comfortably as possible. As I walked through Duke's parking lot, cars driving by 200 feet away on the highway slowed down to honk at me like I was fucking Santa Claus, but I didn't care. I went inside, walked right by the hostess stand, through the bar and restaurant, directly into the bathroom. Nobody stopped me. I think they were much too freaked out for that. In L.A., there are always actors in costumes doing shit around town, so who knows? Maybe they'd already seen a monkey and a donkey come through that day. In the bathroom mirror, I saw that I dug a gaping hole in this prosthetic snout that was covered, as I expected, with white powder. I tried to close it up and hide the damage, but it was fucked. There was a loose flap clinging by a thread. I was now a pig with a deviated septum. Fuck it, I thought, and I went to a stall, sat down on the toilet, and did more lines. When I got back to my car, I realized that I'd been gone for over an hour and still had a 20-minute ride back on the Pacific Coast Highway. Faced with those odds, the only thing that made sense to me was a quick blast of coke for the ride. By now, my straw was no longer necessary. I'd successfully fucked up the makeup to the degree that I could easily do a key hit, which is just what it sounds like, a small pile of coke on the end of a key. I did one of those and started making my way down the PCH. Every time I hit a traffic light, I stopped and did another key hit because I felt so shitty about both the skit and the fact that I was fucking up so bad by being so late. At one red light, as I maneuvered the key up my snout, I felt eyes on me. I turned to my left and saw this fucking hot Malibu chick with long blonde hair and sunglasses, just smoking hot, driving some sort of Lamborghini convertible. She was there with her girlfriend, and the look on their faces was insane. They must have thought they were on an acid trip, sitting there looking at a pig in broad daylight doing cocaine. I just stopped and stared back at him with the key in my hand. Then the driver leaned over so she can get a better look at me and said, kind of disorganized and pointing, "That's a pig doing cocaine." She might have said that, I don't know. I'm going with the odds here and assuming she didn't say, "Hey, you're hot, can I blow you?" I just wanted to kill myself. I thought of my mother holding me in the hospital as a baby, staring into my face, never knowing that one day her baby boy would be in pig makeup at 10 in the morning doing blow at a traffic light. I heard my mother's voice in my head, horrified, saying, "Look at my son, look at him. What's happened to my son?" I was miserable. The light turned green. I started driving with the hit of coke still balanced on the key in my hand. I started weaving in and out of lanes, trying to get this thing in my nose, and ended up cutting off this old lady and almost causing an accident. I got back to the set and put on the rest of my costume, a red Baywatch bathing suit featuring 12 boob cups to hold my 6 set of teats. I stashed my coke in one of them and made some excuse to Jen, the makeup girl, about what happened to the snout. I told her I was drinking coke from a can when it broke. Finally, 6 hours after waking up and 3 hours after my scheduled start time, I joined the cast on set. It was obvious from like 300 yards away that everyone from my fellow actors till the last crew guy wanted to fucking kill me. They were all just livid. My best friend on the show, David Herman, an amazingly talented actor, walked right up to me looking more pissed than I'd ever seen him. "Artie, you almost got the two assistant directors fired," he said. "What the fuck? You have to let those guys know if you're gonna go somewhere." "Oh yeah? Well, fuck you, Dave." "What? What did I do?" "You heard me. Fuck you. I don't give a fucking shit about you or those two fucking guys." I gave him the finger and stormed off. We didn't speak for 2 weeks. I then did the sensible thing. I went back to my trailer and did more coke until it was time to shoot. It was one of those times when cocaine wasn't at all fun. It just got me through the day, because that was the kind of user I'd become. The drugs did have the unwelcome side effect, however, of making the day more and more strange with each passing minute. Every time I bent over to do a line, I'd catch my reflection in the mirror out of the corner of my eye, and I'd see me, as a pig, doing coke. I was a pig doing coke. It was as simple as that. It did wonders for my self-esteem and my growing self-loathing at being an addict. The monologue in my head was like a broken record. I'm a pig. I'm a fucking coke addict pig. I'm a fucking drug addicted pig. The pig costume was more than a symbol of me. As high as I was, when I saw myself in the mirror, I had turned into a pig. A pig who overate and did coke. When you did impressions on Mad TV, the producers gave you a Walkman that played huge sections of whatever movie was being parodied, with your character's catchphrases recorded on a loop. You'd wear this thing around during rehearsals and for a week listen to the voice you had to impersonate over and over again. It drove all of us crazy. When David Herman had to do Paulie Shore, he almost quit. David is a really mellow, great guy who played Michael Bolton in the very funny movie Office Space. On his third day of rehearsals, walking around listening to Paulie Shore tape and practicing saying, "What up, buddy? What's up?" he suddenly, out of nowhere, just tore the headphones off and smashed the Walkman on the floor. "Fuck it. I can't take it anymore," he screamed. "Fuck this. I fucking quit." Eventually, he calmed down. He didn't quit. But when it came time to shoot, Dave did the most amazing Paulie Shore impression ever. But who can blame him? The wheeze is fucking annoying. Anyway, the Walkman treatment made my coked-up pig reality so much harder to take. The rest of the cast were dressed as hot lifeguards. I walked around this beach in Malibu getting ready for my scene by listening to and repeating over and over lines like, "Hey, I'm Babe. Hey, I'm Babe." It was horrible. Then when we shot, the cast and crew looked on while I did things like sit on a lifeguard stand eating a huge piece of chicken, like a pig. In another scene, I had to dig through a garbage can while the entire cast shouted, "You're a pig! You're a disgusting pig!" It was the most surreal day of my life. By the end of it, I was a mess. I'd done so much coke and everything had been so weird that, in my mind, I was convinced that I'd been permanently transformed into a cocaine-snorting, binge-eating pig, which wasn't so far from the truth. When I got back into the makeup chair, I was so amped up and into my delusion that I didn't expect the stuff to come off. As Jen removed it, I could tell she was clearly terrified of me. If she hadn't guessed right away why this hole kept cracking in the base of my snout all day long, I'm sure soon enough she figured it out. My knee was bouncing at about 1,000,000 miles an hour, and every 20 minutes I stopped her so I can go into the bathroom. "Hey, listen, Jen," I'd say, "sorry to do this to you. I really have to go to the bathroom again. I drank a lot of coffee out there today, you know?" "Sure, coffee. That's what everyone drinks when they're on a hot beach for 10 hours. Anyway, I was overjoyed to discover how much easier it was to do coke once I got my God-given nose back, which was good because I was far from finished. I went back to the motel, this awful little dive on the side of the highway, knowing that everyone on the shoot completely hated my guts. All I wanted to do was go home, but we had one more day, so I kept doing coke and drinking Jack until I fell asleep around 3 a.m., about an hour before my 4 a.m. wake-up call. When the phone rang, I felt like I arrived in hell. The only way to describe it is to picture the famous scene in The Godfather, where Jack Walsh wakes up covered in blood with his prize-winning $500,000 racehorse's head in bed with them. As it dawns on him what's happened, he starts screaming over and over, louder and louder, this really disturbing, strangled yell. Ah! 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 That was me. But instead of horse's blood, my bed was full of my own shit. I kept shouting, "What is this? What is this?" My body had so much badness in it, so much coke and booze and bad food, that when I fell asleep, all of it just fell out of me. I had lost all control in that 1 hour. It was so horrible, and there was so much of it, that it filled my jockey underwear, leaked out of every side, and spread all over the bed. And it was everywhere, on my arms, on my chest, up on my neck because I rolled around, exactly like a pig would do, and got it all over myself. When I first saw it, though, I thought it was blood, and I was convinced that someone had come into my room and done something violent to me. Cocaine paranoia is great, by the way. You should try it. Once I realized that, in fact, I was the only one who had done anything violent to me, I was even more horrified. I got up, took a good look at the mess, and it was just terrible. It looked like someone had filled a can of house paint with runny shit and dumped it in the vague shape of a human being on this flea bag bed. The room smelled. I smelled. It was awful. That never happened to me before, even though I was far from being done with excessive drug use. It's never happened since. Whenever I tell this story, I kid myself for a minute by telling myself that it's no big deal because everyone's got a story just like that. Unfortunately, reason wins out eventually. Unless I go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting and make friends, I'm pretty sure I'll never find myself in a room full of people with stories like this. Anyway, I was running late by this point, and judging by the carnage I was looking at, it was only going to get later. I felt cursed. There was no way to keep every single person working on this shoot from fucking hating me. I was going to be late to make up, which once again guaranteed that everything would be delayed. It was a miserable moment standing there in a dark little room in Malibu, feeling this insane pressure. I jumped into the shower and turned the hot water up until it steamed. Then I scrubbed and scorched myself until my entire body was all red. I was clean, but I still felt disgusting. But that didn't matter, because by the time I got out, I was really late. There were people knocking on my door with a van waiting outside just for me, and they were definitely pissed off. I got into some clean clothes, I grabbed my coke, of course, and that's when I realized that I had no idea what the fuck to do about the huge mess on the bed. "Artie, we gotta go, man, the van's waiting." "Okay, sorry, I'm coming, give me 1 minute." The only choice was to flee the scene of the crime. I grabbed the old crappy polyester bedspread, threw it over the horror show and left. I had absolutely no cash at all, so I couldn't even leave the maid a tip. I had coke, though. If I knew she partook, I would have gladly left her some. I got to the set, went to my trailer and did some coke to steady my nerves enough to get me through the 3-hour makeup process. The whole time I was freaking out, convinced that I still smelled like shit, as Jen once again turned my face into a pig. I got on set, hoping that maybe, somehow, my friends on the show had forgiven me for my behavior the day before. Not quite. My buddy, the great actor Orlando Jones, wouldn't even talk to me between scenes. It was too fucked up. I was there, dressed as a pig, with every other actor in the group turning their back on me, ignoring the pig between takes. Somehow I got through that day and was overjoyed to be going home. As I drove back to L.A., feeling bad about the mess I left in the hotel, it hit me. Not only did I almost get the assistant directors fired, but my room had been registered in one of the guy's names. I had showered that place in feces, and I wasn't even the one picking up the tab. What an asshole I was. I started to think of what I was going to say to explain it, and how I could make it up to this guy. Well, that never happened. No one ever said a word about it. I can only assume that they covered the damage. Who knows if anybody ever said anything to anybody. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't. As an eyewitness, I could say that finding that mess was like discovering a decaying corpse. It was so upsetting that they probably made a pact never to speak of it again. After that skit, we had a break before going into another stretch of shooting, which would be the end of the first half of the season. During the time off, I went to San Diego to get my head straight. At the time, I was casually dating a chick down there, so I went to see her. Once I cooled down off the blow, I did some damage control and got everyone talking to me again, though it wasn't easy. But I hadn't learned a thing, and I was far from done with drugs in the workplace. You'd think that waking up in your own crap would be a wake-up call. Not for me. I looked at it as an occupational hazard. No, I kept on doing drugs at Mad TV straight on until dawn. More awful shit was yet to come. Everyone knows that the darkest hour is the one right before the dawn. For me, this incident was just around midnight.
Wah! I'm out of cocaine! Wah!
The most important thing I've learned from working with the amazing Howard Stern for 7 years is that the key to a great radio show and great comedy of any kind is honesty. Though I tried to follow that philosophy as much as possible on The Stern Show and in my stand-up, it hasn't always happened 100%. But it's going to happen here. My goal is for this book to exist as the most honest piece of work I have ever done. The only way to do this for me is to put things on the page that I couldn't share on the air or in any public forum. The story contained here is the most personal revelation I could possibly make and not something that I see much comedy in. I suppose that's why it hasn't made it into my act. The week before The Stern Show left terrestrial radio, each of us on the staff promised to reveal a surprising or highly personal story about ourselves when we got to satellite. That first week at Sirius, we told our shocking stories. I told one about an unfortunate incident I was involved in while attending a Hollywood orgy. But that wasn't the one I was intending to reveal. It was the runner-up. This is a story I would have told if I'd been strong enough to be completely honest that day. When I was 28 years old, I tried to commit suicide. It was no half-assed attempt either. It came complete with a note addressed to my mother and sister. It didn't happen at a time when I was broke. It happened 3 months after my big break. In the fall of 1995, we'd completed the first shooting cycle of Mad TV, the first 9 episodes. Critics loved the show, and the initial ratings were promising. It looked as if the gig was going to last a while. I had my 10th high school reunion coming up, and I couldn't wait to be there and show off. I was a regular on a new, well-received network TV show, and there was more than a few people I was going to enjoy telling. But I never made it to that reunion. Instead, I was in a rehab center recovering. My inability to deal with stress of Mad TV was a combination of pressure I put on myself to deliver and my choice of diet. Cocaine was such a regular part of my day that I started doing things like pouring grams of it into glasses of Jack Daniels and drinking it down 4 or 5 times a week because my nose was too sore. Not a good place to be. It didn't take long for me to develop an ulcer. I ignored it as long as I could. In fact, I made the mistake of thinking that drinking cocaine would numb the stomach pain that seemed to get worse every day. I held out until it became so unbearable that I had to be taken from the Fox lot to St. Joseph Hospital in Burbank for a series of upper gastrointestinal exams. I'll never forget the look on the doctor's face when he walked into the office with my test results. He looked like Lou Costello after he saw the werewolf in the Abbott and Costello Meets Frankenstein. "How old are you, Artie?" he asked. "I'm 27. "You're 27? "Well, the kind of damage you've done to yourself is frightening," he said. "If you want to see 30, you have to stop every bad thing you're doing right now." "Yeah, I know. I don't really eat well." "That's not what I'm talking about," he said, pausing to stare at me for a moment. "The booze and the drugs you're ingesting are tearing your digestive system apart. You have ulcers that will become fatal if you keep going like this. This is very serious. You have to stay off that stuff, starting right now, for 6 months at least. There is no room to negotiate here." "Oh," I said, "I forgot to tell you about all that. This is not a joke, Artie. You need to completely stop everything right now for at least 6 months. It's not funny. You're slowly dying." Whether he was exaggerating or not, he scared me shitless, so I decided to follow the doctor's orders. I had enough of that life anyway. The drugs had stopped being fun a while ago. I thought it would be easy. Half a year? No problem. I had my work to replace the drugs and booze, I thought. I'd dive into the show to keep myself busy and out of trouble. I'd probably do better than ever at work without all that shit getting in the way. All full of those optimistic thoughts, I quit drinking and doing drugs cold turkey in mid-September. I was okay for 2 or 3 days and started to think that addiction was bullshit. But the next day was a different story. After 14 hours of work, the cast and writers decided to take the edge off with a few drinks, and I realized there was no way I could go with them. Afraid that I would fall off the wagon, I went home alone to my apartment. I hear that when people with substance problems make decisions like that, it's empowering. Not for me. I felt like a kid who's been grounded. It didn't help at all that I hated my fucking apartment. Eventually, I would live with Orlando Jones in an amazing loft in downtown L.A. But I'd only just moved out west that summer, and I decided to rent a place in the same housing complex where Fox put me when they flew me out to shoot the pilot. This place is famous for the number of celebrities who lived there when they were nobodies or in really fucked up times in their lives. It's called the Oakwood Apartments in the North Hollywood section of the Valley on Barham Boulevard. I was apartment Y108, a number I will never forget. For those unfamiliar with the Oakwoods, they might be the single most depressing collection of structures ever built. This place is the epitome of corporate housing. It's bland and sterile, with fluorescent lighting and a fake cheerfulness to the whole thing, from the staff to the decor. To this day, whenever I drive by Oakwoods, I get a feeling that must be similar to what a Jew feels like while visiting Auschwitz. In spite of its misery, it was my only refuge. So every day after a rehearsal or a taping, I would retreat there alone to make sure I stayed clean and sober. It wasn't a good time. I was isolating myself from the world and suffering from sickening withdrawal symptoms and an alcohol-related hell called the DTs. I felt achy, feverish, and nauseous all the time, like I had the flu. My physical discomfort was not eased at all by my surroundings, and with each passing night I spent there alone, I slowly descended into madness. I did my best to keep up appearances at work. I gave it all I had, and in general, I think I kept it together. But privately, week after week, I was getting much worse. I go home and stare at the TV with no thoughts in my head. Nothing but a dark gray cloud. I couldn't think. I couldn't sleep. I didn't want to eat. I just lay there in bed. I wouldn't talk to anyone on the phone, and I wouldn't go anywhere. I started having trouble learning my lines, eating anything, or conducting a conversation where I didn't have to. It took every bit of strength I had to keep from missing work, because I knew if I let that happen, I was done for. I drowned in a black hole inside apartment Y108 in the Oakwoods. So I made sure that I was never late, and I did my best never to forget or stumble over a line in a sketch. I had some sort of angel on my shoulder. I hope it was Pop, because that is the only explanation I have for why I was able to keep my obligation to the show. Thank God I did, because it's what saved my life. The people at Mad TV knew there was something really wrong, that I was severely depressed, and they could not have been cooler. They tried to reach out to me, but I didn't even know what to tell them. I was so alienated that I had no idea how to explain what I was feeling. At someone's suggestion, I tried going to a shrink. But aside from a prescription for sleeping pills, I got nothing out of it, really. It was my fault, I guess. I didn't have the ability to get to the bottom of why I felt so bad, even with the help of a trained professional. On the first Friday in November 1995, after the last taping of a long week, I reached the end of my sanity. I could not deal with the physical illness and the feeling of emptiness, the loneliness, and the boredom, and the apathy. By midnight, I started thinking about it, and at 2 a.m., I finally did it. I called my dealer and met him in the parking lot of the Cinerama Dome on Sunset near Cahuenga in Hollywood. I bought a little more than an 8-ball, which would last me an entire weekend. I went back to my apartment Y108 with the Coke and 2/5 of Jack Daniels. I had some sleeping pills around to make sure I went to bed at some point. My plan was to get some relief. Just do a little coke to feel better, but not jeopardize my health or my job. It didn't quite work out that way. I stayed awake all weekend alone in that apartment, snorting blow and drinking whiskey. I sat in one spot of the couch with the TV on, and all my coke and booze and cigarettes spread out on the coffee table in front of me. Next to all that stuff was a brand new packet of 15 sketches that had to be read for the network on Monday. I went through it as I started to get into the drugs and saw that I was going to be busy. I had more than a few scenes, many different characters to do, and a massive amount of lines. I had to do an impression of Newt Gingrich on the show, and hated doing him each and every time. I thought all my impressions sucked, but apparently that one went over well enough to keep bringing it back. Seeing that I had to do Newt again on Monday started a downward spiral, and this one never let up. Believe me, it wasn't a political issue for me at all. If it had been, I might have had more of an excuse for my behavior. I just hated doing impressions. By Saturday night, after having been awake for 24 hours doing line after line of cocaine, I was in such a state that Monday morning seemed like an impossible task. I had no idea how I can get my parts in those scenes ready for the network. The thought of Monday morning became so horrifying that I put it out of my mind by doing another line. It was like a gigantic faraway wall that I knew I could never climb and hoped I'd never have to. But before I knew it, seemingly out of nowhere, it was suddenly 4 a.m. on Monday, and there it was. And right on cue, as my own personal Armageddon was about to unfold, I ran out of coke. I met a kid in rehab who said something very profound about cocaine in one of our group meetings. The best part about cocaine, he said, is going to get it. He couldn't be more right. When I started traveling doing stand-up early in my career, there was nothing as exciting as being in a strange city with someone you just met who knew how to get some coke and made the call. The drive over to get it is always amazing. It's the anticipation of partying that's so intoxicating. It's the best part of the night, before the reality of doing it sets in. If that's the best part about cocaine, the worst part is running out of it. That moment can be devastating. It can bring on uncontrollable feelings of despair and suicide. That is what I was faced with. On top of a network read-through in 4 hours that, to put it mildly, I was unprepared for. I tried to gauge my mental state and decided if I went into work, there was a very good chance I would have some kind of crazy public breakdown and be hauled off in a straitjacket. The panic I felt was out of control. I felt like I was watching some guy who wasn't me, and that guy had officially lost it. In that state, coked and drunk to the gills, I made the worst and darkest decision in a life filled with embarrassing decisions. I came to a conclusion that the only way out for me was suicide, and to this day, I still cannot believe what I did. I had turned 28 3 weeks earlier, and I have lived to see one of my biggest dreams come true. I was told that the producers have booked a total of 8,000 people to audition for just 8 regular slots. We've done our first 9 episodes. They were well received. I was able to start really assisting my mother financially. What else could I have wanted from life? By anyone's estimates, I was doing very well, but cocaine had reduced all of my achievements to nothing. Through the haze of my drugs, my life looked hopeless. I went to the bathroom and got all 30 of my 10-milligram tablets of Restorol, a powerful sleeping pill. I also took out a bottle of Excedrin PM and another pint of whiskey. I figured all of this together would do the trick. I laid it all out in front of me. Then I went and changed my shorts, because after 3 days of sweating on the couch, the ones I had on stunk. I did not want to disgrace myself or my family further by being discovered in dirty underwear. I considered showering, too. I began to worry more about the people who were going to find me than myself. I thought that those people didn't deserve the smell of my foul BO. I debated taking a shower, but I never did in the end. I figured, why bother, since I remembered hearing that your body lets everything go when you die anyway. I was going to be a mess no matter what I did. It's hard to admit any of this, even all these years later, because when I think about it, there is one thing that scares me most of all. I was 100% serious about dying. Once I crossed that bridge to killing myself, I didn't stop to rethink it once. I just barreled ahead. I had the drugs and booze laid out. Then I had some time to look in the mirror and clean up a bit. I would estimate that in my 4 years of high school, a time when everyone cares about how they look, I spent a total of 3 minutes on my clothes and hair. I couldn't have cared less then, but now that I was going to the big dance, I became very concerned with my appearance. I spent at least an hour cleaning up and getting into some nice clothes until I thought I looked okay. Then I sat down to write my note. Because what suicide would be complete without a note? I grabbed a legal pad and my complimentary Oakwood pen and began to write. I addressed it to my mother and sister, the two women who have helped and supported me in every way possible. I was on the verge of ruining their lives, but this is how selfish and narcissistic that fucking drug cocaine makes you. I was so despondent that I could only think about ending my suffering. I couldn't think of theirs. I have not seen the note since I wrote it. It was eventually given to my mother, and I believe she destroyed it, which, to be honest with you, sort of offended me. Throughout high school, my sister always got great grades on papers, which my mom would probably display on the refrigerator. My grades always sucked. So for years, I never had anything on the fridge, but I felt my suicide note had excellent grammar and stellar penmanship. At the very least, it was worthy of a spot on the fridge. That was a lame attempt at levity in this chapter that is nothing but a sea of depressing shit. In any case, I remember the note verbatim. It helps that it was also short and sweet and just how I wanted it. Ma and Stace, I cannot deal with my life. None of this is your fault. Do me a favor and keep on living. Maybe we will see each other again someday. Love, Artie. It took me only one draft, and when I was done, I made sure it was easy to spot there on the coffee table next to all my drugs. Without further delay, I took all 30 Restorols and about 20 Excedrin PM and washed them down with the entire pint of Jack. My body was already in terrible shape from doing a mountain of coke all weekend, so I didn't think it would take long for all of this to do me in. I've been told by psychiatrists and counselors that 80% of the time, people who try to commit suicide panic once they've taken the fatal dose of drugs or slash their wrists and start bleeding. Usually at this point, they call for help, an undeniable sign that they really don't want to die. I was in the other 20%. I sat back on the couch, got comfortable, and waited. When I started to feel the effects of the drugs, my will to die did not change. But I had the weirdest emotional reaction. I was morbidly curious about what was going to happen and obsessively began going over the possibilities. This might be hard to understand, but I was actually excited and looking forward to whatever lay in store for me. I was about to learn the answer to the most asked question in history of mankind. The question that no great scientist, artist, scholar, theologian, or philosopher has ever been able to answer definitely. What happens when we die? I was about to learn if there was a heaven or a hell. Whether I see my father again or I just go to sleep forever and slowly rot away. Discovering the truth made it seem like killing myself was the right thing to do. So I regretted nothing. I just sat there, smiling, as the drugs started to take over. My right arm started to shake, while in my head, I sang the opening line of the Sinatra song, My Way. And now, the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. The trembling in my arm spread to my chest, and then my entire body started convulsing, and then I passed out. I have very blurry memories of slipping in and out of consciousness in my friend David Herman's red Miata convertible. Even though I didn't meet him until I was 27, I've never known a better friend than Dave. He literally and figuratively saved my life. I have these vague images in my mind of him talking to me as we drove. He kept saying, "It's okay now, Artie. It's okay. It's over. You can go back to New York now, and you can get better, okay? It's going to be all right." My next memory is of lying on a gurney in the intensive care unit at St. Joe's Hospital in Burbank as they put a catheter in me. There is one thing I can tell you for sure. No matter how many drugs you have in your system, none of them can kill the pain of having a tube shoved up the hole in your cock. Once I was semi-conscious, they got me to drink this black tar-like substance made of charcoal to save my liver. When I woke up again after that, they pumped my stomach, after which I went to sleep for a very long time. I woke up about 4 o'clock the next morning and felt somewhat normal. I heard someone reading, looked down, and saw that I was in bed with tubes coming out of me every which way. It sounded like somebody was reading the Bible. And when I turned my head, I saw a 350-pound black woman in a chair next to my bed reciting scripture. "Excuse me," I said, "am I in heaven?" "Ha ha ha ha. No, baby, you're in intensive care at St. Joe's," she said. "What are you here for?" "I tried to kill myself," I said, "I guess unsuccessfully."
"You tried to kill yourself," she said. "Baby, you cannot do that. If you kill yourself, you go straight to hell. Life is a precious gift. You can't take this gift we've been given for granted."
"Oh, yeah," I said. "Yeah, I know." I had nothing else positive to add to the conversation, so I went back to sleep. The next time I woke up, it was early afternoon, 36 hours or more since I tried to kill myself. David Herman and Mad TV director John Blanchard were in the room and they cheered me up a bit. Then later on, Orlando Jones and Nicole Sullivan came by to visit too. And they were really sensitive and gave me incredible uplifting pep talks. The four of them then told me how I've been saved. When I did not show up for work, the two assistant directors, Josh Berger and Tara Passanda, got worried. Josh was actually the guy that I left holding the bag in my hotel room in Malibu. I can't imagine how sick of me he must have been. He dealt with my shit, and now he was dealing with my shit again. This time on a metaphysical level. Josh and Tara called my room and got no answer, so they decided to drive over to my place, which was just down the street, to investigate. They knocked on the door for a while, and just as they were ready to give up, I answered in a stupor. Unable to speak coherently and swaying all over the place, they didn't know what was wrong with me. So they grabbed me by the arms, led me back inside, and sat me down on the couch. That's when they saw the note. They immediately called the studio, and David Herman answered the call and rushed right over. They also called 911, but David beat the authorities there. So they put me in his car and drove me to the hospital. The producers then did all the right things. They got rid of the drugs, dealt with the EMTs when they showed up, and called my mom and sister back in Jersey, who flew out immediately. This lovely occasion was my mother's first visit to California. When she entered the room, she looked great. She was strong, powerful, and classy through it all. And she did not, for a minute, let me see her cry. She came over to the bed, gave me a hug, and said, "We gotta get you better, Artie. We gotta get you better." My sister was the same way, and their strength gave me hope. Some parents would have fallen apart, but not my mom. She is a special woman, and she deserves every cent I earn in this life. Not that she'd ever take it. It's the only way I can think to repay her for all she has done for me. Among the many reasons I've never told this story publicly, the most important one is this. I was afraid that someone might think that my mother had failed in any way as a parent. Nothing could be further from the truth. My mother is the greatest person I have ever known. A better mother would be hard to imagine. I didn't learn any of my bad behavior from her. All of my tendencies were in me. They are part of my personality. If anything, the values and knowledge that my mother passed on to me are the only ones that kept me alive. Seeing my mother and sister there made me feel well enough to think about what I had to do in my life. After another night in the hospital, I went back to Jersey with them, entered rehab, and began counseling. For their part, everyone involved with Mad TV was fantastic. The two guys who ran the show, Fax Bear and Adam Small, never made me feel guilty or bad for what happened. They were understanding and willing to give me all the time I needed to recover. Those two guys are the reason I lasted through the tough first year of Mad TV, both before and after the incident. And they deserve so much credit for my achievements there. I will never forget their tolerance during the shittiest time in my life. I owe them a lot. And the same goes for the coolest guy I ever met, John Blanchard. Quincy Jones and his partner, David Salzman, who owned the show, were amazing too. They treated my mother and sister and me with such respect. David is a good man, and Quincy is unbelievable. He's one of the most remarkable men I've ever met in my life. I've had about 7 or 8 conversations with Quincy in the 2 years I've worked with him at Mad TV, and they remain the greatest talks I've ever had about life with anybody. Anyone who has ever met Quincy knows why so many people thank him when they win awards. He is an extraordinary man. In January, after I got through rehab, I returned to the set. When Quincy saw me, he walked right over and gave me a big hug. "Man, I've been thinking about you," he said in that smooth, calming voice of his. "I'm glad you're back, Artie. You're funny. We need you. And your job is still here." "Thank you, Mr. Jones," I said. "Really embarrassed about what I've done. I'm doing a lot better, and I just want to say I'm sorry. You know, I let the drugs get a hold of me." "Listen, man," he said. "The greatest towns in the world have drug problems. Miles Davis did, too. It took him a while to beat his demons. Don't let that happen to you." "No, I won't," I said. "I just want you to know that I thank you, and I appreciate everything you've done for me." "Listen, I love you, man. I want you to stay well." Quincy was amazing. He even sent his private jet to fly me back out to Los Angeles. Talk about a thrill. 3.5 years before, I was unloading orange juice in Port Newark. And there I was, after having flown in on Quincy Jones' plane, being compared by Quincy to Miles Davis in a heart-to-heart conversation. That moment alone inspired me to give my all to keep it together. I wanted to work, and I wanted to be back among my castmates. I moved in with Orlando Jones, which made the producers happy because they knew Orlando would keep an eye on me. My pal David Herman gave me a hug and welcomed me back. I am still great friends with David, and knowing him has made me a better man. I wish I could say the same for Orlando. He was an amazing friend to me, and I loved that kid, but for some reason we have not spoken to each other in 12 years. I wish I knew why. I'm happy to see that he's gone on to be very successful. He deserves all of the good that comes to him, because he's a great talent and a special guy. I just hope that I see him again someday so that we can get a chance to reminisce about all the fun times we had. It doesn't matter to me that we haven't spoken. Orlando saved my life, and there's nothing I wouldn't do for him. If I found out that for any reason he wasn't happy, it would make me unhappy, and I'd do whatever I could to help out. And just in case he's listening to this, I'd like to say, Mr. O. Jones, I miss you. After my stint in rehab, I returned to Mad TV in a better place and with a clarity I've never had before. My work on the second half of the first season was the best work I have ever done in sketch comedy by far. I wrote and co-wrote sketches that made it to the air, and I created a recurring character, White Mama, that became a favorite of the fans of the show. When I was clean, my talent level was through the roof. But as often is the case, when it comes to jerks like me, it didn't last. I wasn't comfortable having things too good for too long. So in time, I fucked up again. And when I did it big. I never tried offing myself again, and thank God I didn't succeed. Because I think it's a terrible selfish act for anyone who has people that love them in their life. This hasn't been easy for me to get out, and I'm still ashamed of my actions that night. I can't believe I'm putting this out into the world. But I made a promise to myself to do it, and I'm going to keep it. I don't think admitting my suicide attempt publicly is going to help me as a talent or as a performer. And I don't want to be any kind of role model, but I do hope that this story helps somebody else. There is one thing I've learned the hard way in life. If you can't help making stupid mistakes yourself, you can try to stop other people from making them. If I accomplish that by sharing this, I'm glad. My confession is now yours. Let it be my gift. If it's true that you're supposed to learn from your mistakes, I should be fucking Einstein by now. That's it. Take it easy, everybody. The end.